So anonymous whistleblowing, the ethics of anonymous whistleblowing. I wanted to start out with a reference to one story of many. But it's really a dramatic one. You can see it in source number one on your sheet. Challenger's whistleblower, hero, and outcast from the scientist. When the shuttle Challenger blew up, the explosion lit a fuse in Roger, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, Beaujolais, is that... Beaujolais, okay. In his conscience. A structural engineer for Morton Thiokol Incorporated, the firm that later bore blame for the disaster, he had argued against the launch the night before. And like the rest of the nation watched in horror when the shuttle blew up. If you remember the story with the O-rings, that when the weather was too cold, they were not flexible enough. And the result was a leaking of gases that led to the Challenger blowing up. He said, I left the room and went directly to my office where I remained in shock the rest of the day. He recalls about that terrible morning 4 years ago this week. During the next 8 months, Roger would become both a national hero and a professional pariah. And the story really was that he had actually protested beforehand and said they should not launch the shuttle. And they insisted that you had to launch it, that you could take the risk, that he should stop thinking like an engineer and think instead like whatever it is that they wanted him to think like. And this is one case among many, but it's a very dramatic one that demonstrates the importance of the whistleblower. Somebody who's going to say, this isn't right. And had he done so, a lot of lives would have been saved. Much money would have been saved as well, when, for those who are thinking from that perspective. The space program would have advanced instead of being on hold for years after that happened. Here's my question, though. Did he do what he was supposed to do? Did he do his duty as a whistleblower? I mean, did he do enough? What would we expect from somebody in his situation?
Well, didn't he tell the higher-ups?
He told the higher-ups, yes. So did he do his duty?
Well, look, the prophets warned Bene Israel.
We're not talking prophets. I'm talking
engineers.
Yeah, the prophets warned the Jews. This is true. Okay,
so
the fundamental question that I'm asking here is, if you report inside your business and no one listens to you, do you have a duty to go beyond? Do you have a duty to go outside of the firm? Should he have gone to the media and said something, as one example? That's one question. Second, I wanted to show you the second source here, mostly to show off my Spanish. No, I did it in Google Translate. This is a law that's been in the works before the Spanish Parliament for quite a long time. I found a version of it in 2015, 2016, and so on, until June 2018. My Spanish is not good enough to tell whether it's ever been accepted, but I don't think so. They're working on it. But it relates to whistleblowing. As you see, the title, Proposed Law Against Corruption and Protection of Whistleblowers. So the opening lines there are in Spanish, and then you see the translation below it. And this is the law. All complaints that show a minimum appearance of truth will be admitted. Anonymous complaints will not be processed, nor will those that cannot be supported by documents or contrasted information. Okay? Complaints of corruption that are presented anonymously will not be processed. Is that right or wrong? To reject automatically anonymous whistleblowing.
Wrong.
Why wrong?
Basically, a lot of people will never come. If their name mentioned, you know, they're geared for confidentiality. Nobody will listen. So basically, they'll never come forward if there's no guarantee that they're not going to be there.
So the argument is you need to have the option of anonymous whistleblowing or else people won't come forward. Anyone want to make the opposite argument? That they're right for this?
Well, the difficult way to verify that people don't do it out of spite or...
Right. So I point out the weakness. Right? Moshe is correct that you want to encourage people to blow the whistle, and anonymous, you know, affording anonymity is a strong way to do it. You're giving people protection. On the other hand, there's no accountability when you're anonymous. And therefore, people can and do say whatever they want. You can see it on blogs. You can see it everywhere. Whistleblowing is a sport. So the questions I'd like to address are, number one, we'll talk about what is whistleblowing. Number two, what factors affect the decision whether to blow the whistle, whether within the rules of CPA Ontario or within halacha, Jewish law? And the and then third, is anonymous whistleblowing appropriate? There's a whole lot more. No, that, 1 second. Just a second. Just 1 second. I'm not going to deal with the following issues, not because they're uninteresting, but because of time. I don't intend to discuss the issue of reprisal, fear of reprisal, risking your job to blow the whistle. It's an important topic. It's just beyond the scope of what we're going to get to. The issue of whistleblowing protection legislation, as well as the very interesting, but also beyond the scope, discussion of Mesira, whether there's any challenge of turning somebody over to the authorities if you fear that the authorities are going to mistreat them. So it's a good discussion also, but again, beyond the scope of where we are right now. I want to talk about the decision to blow the whistle in and of itself, as opposed to the fear of repercussions for having done so. Yes, Moshe?
To counter your argument, you still can have anonymous complaint to support the documents. So basically, no one gave the documents to you. So there's proof that it actually exists, but it's anonymous.
Right, so Moshe floats the idea that there may be ways to bridge the gap, and there is a way to bridge the gap. We'll talk about it at the end, God willing. But the truth of the matter is that the counter to all of the methods of assuring anonymity is modern technology, which is to say, you can do whatever you like, but we have, through data processing, the means of analyzing somebody's text that they gave with their report and seeing which words they used in order to figure out who it was who actually wrote it. If you give an envelope, you better be holding it with gloves, or they're going to pick up your fingerprints. The reality is anonymity in 2018 is hard to come by. But let's talk through the issues. Let's start with the definition of whistleblowing. So there's a group called the CSA group that created a report here in Canada called the Whistleblowing Systems a Guide. And they're trying to sell the how you set up a whistleblowing system within an organization. But you have to know they have an agenda. And their agenda is to sell you whistleblowing systems. And therefore, they are very broad and they go way beyond their evidence in terms of some of the things they say. You have to know that. They give you a very broad definition of whistleblowing, which I brought you part of in source number 3. First of all, in terms of what you are reporting, the types of misconduct reported may range from ineptitude to mismanagement to illegality, unethical conduct, or any action that may result in harm to the organization, the public interest, or health, safety, and the environment, whether intentional or not. It includes everything, basically. Everything and the kitchen sink. So, ineptitude is something that would qualify for whistleblowing. I think that my coworker, my boss, or somebody within the organization is not doing his job well. So they're going to call that whistleblowing if I go to superiors within the company to address this person's ineptitude. Not everybody agrees that should qualify as whistleblowing, as we're going to see. Whistleblowing means reporting concerns to people or entities who are believed to be in a position to take action. That's a very important point, which we're going to come back to. Meaning, is it whistleblowing if I just publish something on a blog? Is that whistleblowing? Let's say I need to give you a better case, and I can't just give you a random case. Let's say I have a job as the controller for a firm. If I have a job as the controller for a firm, and I know that there's fraud that's going on within the firm, and let's say I've gone to the people who are responsible within the firm, and nobody's listening to me, and I decide I'm going to publish that on my blog, is that whistleblowing?
It's kind of out there. Like, it's hard to say. It's not laser focused. It's sort of like same things, but not whistleblowing.
So the general consensus is that this doesn't qualify as whistleblowing, or more to be more precise, it doesn't qualify as positive whistleblowing, the type that should be protected, because it's just out there in the open. It's not targeted to people who can actually do anything about it. It's just lashon hara, to use our terminology. It's just harmful speech. Keep on reading. Disclosures are not the same as complaints. Whistleblowing is about trying to protect others from harm, including harm to the organization, workforce, public, or environment. An individual who is complaining about personal matters, however legitimate, is not blowing the whistle. That's not called blowing the whistle if it's, I am being hurt. That's a different type of a situation. But they're very broad. They include ineptitude. They also include the health of the organization as a reason to blow the whistle. A narrower definition, it starts with Ralph Nader in 1972. Take a look at source number 4. Whistleblowing was defined in 1972 by Ralph Nader as, quote, an act of a man or a woman who, believing in the public interest, overrides the interest of the organization he serves, publicly blows the whistle if the organization is involved in corrupt, illegal, fraudulent, or harmful activity. You notice? Number one, he takes out ineptitude. It's about something that is willful. And number two, he's talking about where it's the good of the organization versus the good of the public. It's about protecting the public, and it's about specifically intent and corruption. And that tends to be the definition that those who write on this topic work with, the more narrow type of a definition. Take a look at source number 5, Professor John McAvoy, Canadian fellow. I'm blanking now on where he is a professor. But he wrote chapter 2 of a book called Whistleblowing, a Comparative Study. In the labor and employment law context, a whistleblower is an employee who discloses otherwise confidential information gained in the course of employment. The disclosed information may relate to, quote, illegal, immoral, or illegitimate practices undertaken by or on behalf of the employer, such that its disclosure is detrimental to the employer's interests. An employee seeking corrective action typically makes the disclosure to, quote, persons or organizations that may be able to affect action. But disclosures are also made to the public at large through news and social media. Such disclosures risk the business reputation of the employer and may expose the employer to prosecution. So, again, public interest and what people are doing that has to be disclosed is something illegal, immoral, or illegitimate. And the last source on this that I wanted to show you is number 6. Rabbi Dr. Aaron Levine, in his Moral Issues of the Marketplace in Jewish Law, has a large chapter on the issues of whistleblowing, and he quotes a professor, Richard DeGeorge, who emphasizes the employee must have good reasons to believe that by going public, the necessary changes will be brought about. Moshe.
Legal reasons. So, forget about this. There's a legal reason why an employee should disclose. Because they themselves, if they don't disclose, and if there's fraud or something found out, they themselves can be charged because they might be involved in it. So by them disclosing, they basically stop any prosecution against them directly.
Right. So one thing that I should delineate here very clearly is that we're not talking about where the whistleblower is personally involved in the activity. If the whistleblower is personally involved in the activity, then effectively they are doing this in order to save themselves from liability. I'm talking about somebody who has no liability personally at all and is only doing it in order to prevent the harm that's being done. Alan?
I just think you have no legal liability
right.
Or legal responsibility to disclose anything.
Correct. This is somebody who is, to use Hebrew, lishma. He's doing it altruistically. We hope. We're going to come back to the question of motivation. What if he's doing it because he doesn't like the person in the firm who's doing this? We have to talk about that.
Or financial gain.
Right.
Or his employment was terminated.
Right. I mean, again, that would qualify as a reason not to like the person in the firm he's talking about. I brought you a link in source number 7, or two links, to a video by a fellow named Sandy Boucher. Sandy worked for the police and is now an investigator of whistleblowing complaints. And he argues with statistics that whistleblowers are actually the most common way that these problems are found, even beyond internal audits. He showed some remarkable statistics about research that's been done in Canada on this, and whistleblowers are by far the greatest source for finding this sort of, what was the term that we used before, illegal, immoral, or illegitimate practices. And the reason is very simple. Because what better way is there to find out what's going on than to have somebody from inside come and give you the information? Right? It makes sense. So what we see here is we're talking about somebody who wants to protect society. We're talking about somebody who thinks that the business is not going to listen. I didn't emphasize this enough before, but that's why ineptitude doesn't really qualify. Because when you're dealing with a case where there's just ineptitude, so you report it to somebody who's a higher up in the firm, unless the ineptitude is the CEO, you report it to somebody who's higher up within the firm, and they deal with the problem. If it's just somebody making a mistake, it can be corrected in-house. If you need to go outside, it has to be that the feeling is the business is not going to listen. And we're talking about making changes, not only broadcasting guilt. So, there is a history of whistleblowing in Judaism as well. As we're going to see, there is a mitzvah in the Torah. If people are doing something wrong, we have a mitzvah of tochacha, a mitzvah of rebuke, a mitzvah of education. We have mitzvot of standing up on behalf of potential victims. We're going to talk about all of that. And classically, we had methods of whistleblowing that we evolved to address general wrongdoing. One of them is chayra. Somebody would report to a beit din, to a court, this person is conducting this improper activity, and the court would do its own investigation, and the court could issue a ban. It could issue a chayrim, it could issue an excommunication. However, not everybody went through the courts. One of the less institutional whistleblowing methods is what's called the pashkevil. People are familiar with the pashkevil, right? You can't miss them in Israel. That's right. The pashkevil is a sign up on a wall broadcasting your view of somebody's wrongdoing to the world. Take a look at source number 8. From an article, Shaming in Judaism, Past, Present, Future. I have to credit where credit is due. Rabbi Ziri sent me this article when we were preparing a different program last year. It's a fun article. Listen to this, because I didn't know the origin of the word pashkevil. I always assumed it's got to be Yiddish. Take a look. In cases where communal authority did not provide the tools for the rabbinical court to punish the transgressor, or when, for whatever reason, the leaders did not want to impose such harsh punishments as excommunication, we find a further practice of public shaming, particularly within the ultra-Orthodox community, that involved a print communications medium, the pashkevil. Shaming via pashkevilim was carried out in the spirit of the edict from the Talmud, publicized the flatterers before a defamation of God's name. The stress here is on sins committed secretly, or on people who pretend to be righteous. That's what the Talmud is talking about. And the disclosure is designed to warn the public about their actions. The Yiddish word pashkevil, it is Yiddish, derives from the name of a citizen of Rome by the name of Pasquino, who used to hang satires and critical comments about the Pope on the pedestal of a headless statue. His name was eventually given to the statue, and then to the square where the statue stood. The initiative taken by one individual evolved into a common practice whereby citizens hung anonymous vilifying signs around the city. The phenomenon spread throughout Western Europe during the 16th century as this channel began to accompany religious and social struggles. So that was your method of whistleblowing. You'd put a poster up on the wall and let the world know that so-and-so is a bad guy. However, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, writing in the beginning of the 20th century, was very against this the practice of the pashkevil. One wonders if he put up a pashkevil to this effect. But take a look at source number 9 from his work Shmirat HaLashon on guarding your tongue. He said it's part of a longer piece in which he compares somebody who speaks harmfully about others to someone who is bitten by a rabid dog and who has some of the traits of this rabid dog. So he says, and in the interest of time, when I have a Hebrew source, I'm just going to read out the English. I brought the Hebrew for authenticity, but I'll read out the English. He says, some say that one who speaks harmfully is like one who has been bitten by a rabid dog in that he also barks inaudibly. For with his harmful speech, he causes harm in secret. And especially those who write amal, called pashkevilin, regarding whom it says, cursed is the one who strikes his fellow in secret. The Torah has a line, arur, makere eu basater, cursed is one who strikes somebody else in secret. That's the person who publishes a pashkevil anonymously. He was not a fan of this anonymous whistleblowing via posters. We're going to come back to that quote when we deal with anonymity. But the question here is now, we've defined whistleblowing. We've seen that it has ancient precedent as precedent for centuries and centuries in the Jewish community and in the broader world. So how do you decide when it is allowed, when it is appropriate, when it may be required? So the calculation of whether to blow the whistle is based on the goals and circumstances that we've already started to discuss above. The issue of looking out for the public interest, the issue of dealing with behavior which is willful and wrong. So the arguments in favor of blowing the whistle, first of all, are the public interest. And take a look at source number 10. This is from the CPA of Ontario Act, Chartered Professional Accountants of Ontario Act. And those who were here last year when we talked about confidentiality will recognize it because we discussed it then as well. Every person engaged in the administration of this act and the bylaws shall preserve secrecy respecting information or material that comes to his or her knowledge or possession in the course of his or her duties under this act, a predecessor act, or the Public Accounting Act of 2004, and shall not disclose any such information or material to any person except, and there are a few exceptions, you're subpoenaed by a court that determines that you have to and so on, but one of the exceptions is if there are reasonable grounds for believing that there is a significant risk of harm to any person if the disclosure is not made, and that making the disclosure is likely to reduce the risk. So this is one point. Disclose it in order to prevent harm. As we discussed when we dealt with confidentiality, the statute is written in a very vague way, as opposed to the Law Society's rule, which is very specific about what constitutes harm and what does not. So they say physical harm, they say serious bodily harm, and they reject financial harm. Here it just says harm. But the grounds for blowing the whistle, number one, is to prevent harm. But it's not only about preventing harm to the public, because there really is also the issue of the good of the business itself. Why are whistleblowers good for business? For the business they're reporting on, mind you, not for the competition. Why is it that whistleblowers are good for the business they're reporting on? Maybe. I mean, one,
prevents future harm.
Prevents future harm? I mean, on a very simple level, assuming that you report the way you're supposed to, which we're going to talk about, which is that you start internally, you go up the ladder within the business, so you're helping them discover their problems. You're uncovering the issue. The business doesn't benefit if somebody within the firm is committing fraud. So directly, you are benefiting the firm. But also indirectly, because if you don't say anything, the challenger is going to blow up. You can't think that the challenger blowing up is good for Morton Thiokol, right? They get to manufacture more O-rings now when they have to produce a replacement. It's not good for the business if what they're doing wrong comes to light later on or causes a disaster later on. They're playing a very risky game. So therefore, you're helping them. But you're also helping them for another reason, which is...
If you know there's harm... and people will get fired.
Yeah. So,
are you colluding if you don't report it? But then you would get them fired.
Right. So I'm coming back to that. It's a good, Howard asked an important question. I'm going to come back to the question that he asks about what about the harm to the people within the firm you're reporting on. Hang in there. But the other issue is that people don't necessarily realize it. In the event that you don't create an avenue for people to blow the whistle within the business, they may go elsewhere and report it elsewhere. And in a way that hurts you more. This is something that I found fascinating. I believe I brought it here. Yeah, take a look at source number 11. This is the Kitam issue, right? People are familiar with Kitam? It sounds Hebrew or Aramaic, but it's not. It's Latin. So the concept is this. Under this type of rule, which we're about to see, the Kitam lawsuit, those who are making a claim on behalf of the crown, or whatever your jurisdiction is, are considered to be making a claim on behalf of themselves. And therefore, if there is some kind of large settlement that emerges from it, they're entitled to receive some of the money. Not in Canada, it doesn't exist in Canada, but it exists in the U.S. So take a look at source number 11, Blowing the Whistle on Fraud, from Canadian Lawyer. Most tips, talking about tips that come to the SEC... most tips come from California, followed by New York and Florida. The SEC received 62 tips from Canadians, Gray says, last year, making it the second most active country behind the UK. That was up from 46 Canadian tips last year. But it's not just Dodd-Frank and Sarbanes-Oxley that can trip Canadian companies up when it comes to whistleblowers. Gray notes there is also the U.S. False Claims Act, which allows whistleblowers to file what's called a Kitam lawsuit against a party that has financially defrauded the federal government. It can actually reward hefty payments to whistleblowers and impose pretty hefty fines for companies that are offside, Gray says. So you could have a situation in which a Canadian company does not create a system for people to blow the whistle, and the result is that they say, okay, I'm going to go to the SEC. I'm going to file the Keytom lawsuit. I don't know if it's Keytom or Keytom. I keep saying Tom. I don't know. But someone's going to say, I'm going to file such a lawsuit, and I'll make money on it. So for that reason, whistleblowing is actually the better situation for the business itself. I mentioned the CSA group before as a group that overreaches a little bit in promoting whistleblowing. They make the argument that whistleblowing is necessary for the psychological well-being of the workers, because they quote studies that show that people who feel they're working for an unjust business will feel frustration, and that will be bad for their mental health. I think they're pushing it a little bit, but that's their argument. Yes.
I'm sure you get into this, but it's a little more complicated than that. I mean, there's a case involving Raytheon. I think it was Raytheon, which overcharged the U.S. government, and there was a whistleblower involved. They made a significant amount of money, but the end result of it was that Raytheon was barred from doing business in the U.S. government for a period of years, or in certain sectors of the U.S. government here.
Right.
That's one example. Another example is basically bribes from third world countries, where without the bribes, there's no business in those countries. With the bribes, there is business in those countries, and the disclosure of those bribes results in harm to companies in the sense of not being able to do business in this country. For example, Lavaland is a perfect example of that. It's
right.
More complicated.
Right. So Alan makes two points. The second point I'm not really going to be dealing with here as much, because it's a broader question of identifying wrongdoing. What do you do? Are you going to blow the whistle on something which is actually standard practice in the industry? And, you know, some may argue, I'm not necessarily arguing, but some may argue, therefore, is not considered unethical, but you're going to get them into trouble. That point I'm not going to spend real time on, because I think that's a separate question of how do we view industry practices which are fundamentally illegal, but everybody's doing them. The first point, though, that he made is the harm done to the business, and the harm which may be out of proportion with the wrongdoing. And that's exactly where I'm going next. I've given the reasons why one should report and why companies should encourage the act of reporting. It's good for society, and it's good potentially for the business, both directly and indirectly. But what about your duty to your employer? You have a duty to your employer. Take a look at source number 12 from the CPA Code of Professional Conduct, Section 202, Guidance 5. Members and firms have duties to those to whom they provide professional services that arise from the nature of the relationships with the recipients of the services. Members and firms have a professional duty to act with integrity, due care, contractual duty to provide services. In certain cases, the relationship between a member or firm and those to whom they provide professional services could also be one that the courts describe as a fiduciary relationship that gives rise to fiduciary duties. You have a duty to your employer. So that includes the people who are going to lose their jobs potentially or their income as a result of the reporting that you do. And it's going to have to dictate the way that one blows the whistle. That's why we're going to talk about going up the ladder, reporting internally as opposed to going outside, making sure that you handle it internally if at all possible. There are also practical problems with whistleblowing. I mean, Alan leads in that direction by talking about the fact that you may not be aware of everything that you're seeing, or you may not understand all of the circumstances. But Rabbi Dr. Levine points out in source number 13, nor is it clear that asking employees to act in that capacity, meaning they all become investigators, would make for a productive corporate atmosphere. Such a requirement would turn a normal society into a police state or cultivate a police state mentality among its citizens. You want everybody looking over their shoulder at what the next person is going to say about them. That makes things very difficult. This is from a secular perspective. From a secular perspective, the motivation to tell, it's good for society, it's good some ways for the business. On the other hand, you have a duty to your employer, and there are practical issues of whistleblowing. You may not know what you're seeing, and we don't want to put people in the position of becoming reporters on everybody else, not to mention it's not what they were hired to do. What about from a halachic perspective? So some of the halachic imperative to tell goes back to basic things that we've already identified. So, for example, there is a duty to the victims of the impropriety that's going on. I brought you source number 14, based on a pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim. The Torah says, "Velo samod al dam reyecha." Do not stand by as another person's blood is shed. So, source number 14. Minayin l'roes chaveru. I said I wasn't going to read the Hebrew out loud. How do we know that if one sees somebody else drowning in a river, being dragged by an animal, or being attacked by bandits, how do you know he's obligated to save that person? The Torah says, "Don't stand by." So, if I am aware, number 14. If I am aware that people could be harmed by the impropriety going on in this business, there are passengers on the shuttle, whatever the case may be, I have a responsibility to save them from that harm. And that's applied in halacha. That's applied in Jewish law in a variety of ways. So, for example, for example, when you're dealing with physical harm, when you're dealing with an issue of potential physical harm, rabbinic authorities are very clear. I have an obligation to act in order to prevent that harm. Not talking about in a business case. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, the Tzitz Eliezer, dealt with a case in which somebody knew there was an epileptic person vulnerable to seizures who had just had their driver's license renewed. So he says, of course you're obligated to inform the authorities. You have to make sure to save people from harm.
Wouldn't that be Miss Sarah?
No. I'm sorry, I shouldn't be that quick. Right.
So let's say like there's a measles epidemic. I won't call it an epidemic, but some kids who aren't vaccinated are going to schools and kids are getting sick.
Right.
So if you know that somebody is pretending,
right. So Cheryl asks the Mesira question. So, you know, I did say in the beginning I'm really not going to deal with Mesira, but I will say this. Where somebody poses a risk, and you're talking physical risk here to others, there is absolutely no issue of Mesira. And that's been discussed on a variety of issues ranging from child abuse to the cases here. Absolutely no issue of Mesira. You're talking about people who pose a life and death risk to others. But I really said I wasn't going to do Mesira, and I'm serious about that. Jeff, is that on Mesira or something else?
No. Prior to your last point,
yeah.
There are duties to report on certain professionals in certain circumstances. Given that there's no general duty to report.
Correct.
For example, you as a private citizen who knows
correct.
That there's an epileptic. So does that suggest that in our society, according to our civil society, that's not the philosophy, that's not what
it is. Yeah, I mean, last year when we spoke about confidentiality, we went into it in depth. But yes, that's correct. Ontario does not have a duty of care unless you have a special relationship as defined by either your actual relationship with the person or being in certain professions. And therefore, correct, if you did not notify, you knew about it, and you didn't do anything about it, and then afterwards, God forbid, there's an accident, whatever happens, you have no vulnerability, you have no liability. That's the law as written in Ontario. Quebec is different, but that's Ontario.
From a Jewish perspective, can you say, I want to satisfy, laws of the state?
Yes. No, but from a Jewish perspective, you would have an obligation, but how that's executed, I'm going to refer you back to what I said last year rather than reopen that. The financial question, what if the harm is not physical? It's not the epileptic driver. What if we're talking about financial harm? Do you have a responsibility then to blow the whistle and inform in order to prevent harm to somebody if it's only financial harm? Take a look at source number 15 from Rabbi Moses Maimonides, his book of mitzvot, prohibition number 297, in which he says, talking about the duty to rescue, when we see that someone is in danger of death or loss, and we are capable of rescue, we're obligated to do so. There's some debate about Maimonides' position because there's another source that you could bring also from Maimonides that seems to indicate otherwise, but as a matter of practice, the position of contemporary authorities in Jewish law is indeed that you would have to report in order to avoid financial harm to people as well. So there's a duty to the victim under this principle of not standing by while somebody's blood is shed. There's a secondary argument that's brought that it's the issue of hashavat aveda. You have an obligation. If somebody loses their property, you have an obligation to restore it to them, assuming that you have it available. And so that may also trigger a responsibility to intervene. So those are reasons to blow the whistle, which mirror the secular. The secular argument also was protection of society. But Judaism goes further in this regard, because it imposes not only a duty to society, but a duty to the criminal. It's for your own good, we will say, as we blow the whistle and watch him led away in chains. There's a duty to the criminal as well. The Torah writes, "Hocheach tochiach et amitecha." You have an obligation to instruct others in right behavior. I brought you a passage from the Talmud in source number 16. I'm just going to read you the second part of it, the second paragraph there. How far does one go to rebuke? How far do you have to go to rebuke somebody? Rav says until he hits you. Shmuel says, nah, just until he curses you. Rabbi Yochanan said, until he gets angry. This is like a debate among sages going back to an earlier time, the period of the Mishnah, who also had this debate. You have a great responsibility to instruct people, and this is part of, there are some lawyers here also. I'll note that on Monday night at Shari Shemayim, 7:30 p.m., I'm going to be speaking on the what do you do when you have a dishonest client, and this will figure into that discussion. But don't say bill him. That's not the thing. But the point here, and what I'm trying to say here, is that in addition to the duty to society, you have a religious obligation as a Jew to the person who's doing the wrong. And then there is a potential third level of duty religiously, which is the duty to God. Several times the Torah states, "Ubi'arta hara mikirbecha," you shall eradicate evil from your midst. Rabbeinu Asher, a major legal authority, wrote in source number 17, anyone who sees divar erva, which I translate as impropriety here, erva is not literal here, it means some kind of inappropriate behavior, is obligated to testify fulfilling that verse, you shall eradicate evil from your midst. Granted that, you have to do it in a way that will be effective. The point is not simply to tell the world, I saw what so-and-so did. And the proof of that is another passage. Take a look at source number 18. It speaks of three types of people whom God despises. A very strong word. But sonan is the Hebrew. And the third type of person who God despises is somebody who witnesses impropriety by somebody else and testifies alone. What's wrong with testifying alone?
No witnesses.
Well, you're one witness, but you need two in order for anything to happen. Right, a court cannot act on a lone witness. The truth of the matter is it's more complicated than this, because there are things a court can do when it receives word from one witness. But the general point is, and this is the message of this passage, it's not your imperative is not simply report. Your imperative is report in a productive way, such that something can be done about it. But this is your duty now to God. So the imperative to blow the whistle is even greater in Judaism than it is in the secular law. What about the flip side? What about the other side, the argument not to blow the whistle? So we saw within the secular system the argument that you have a duty to your employer, right? Your employer and whoever is going to get hurt by you reporting, as well as you have practical problems. The fact that you may not know, and the fact that putting people in the position of being police for each other is very dicey. Well, within Judaism, we have an added dimension here, which is religious, which is, in general, Judaism is very strong in its opposition to tale-bearing. Whether the tale is true or not true doesn't help you. You're not supposed to go spreading things about people. So take a look at source number 19. This is one example. We've seen this here in this room before, where the Talmud states, how do we know that one may not repeat something that somebody tells him unless the person says, go tell it? Because the Torah says, God spoke to Moses from the tent of meeting, lemur, telling him, go tell this to the Jews. A communication is confidential by default. Unless someone tells you, tell it to somebody else. And this is important for the sake of communal peace. Take a look at source number 20, the Sefer HaChinuch, which was written anonymously, but many people think Rabbi Aaron Halevi was the author in 13th century Spain, explains why it is I'm not supposed to tell. Among the roots of this command is that God desires the good of his creations. And he instructed us in this, so that there should be peace among us, as gossip is cause for quarreling and strife. You're not supposed to go around tale-bearing. That's number one. Number two, lashon hara, harmful speech in general, even if it's not tale-bearing. I'm not running around circulating the story. I just tell one person the story, and that's all I'm doing. There's an issue of harmful speech, which has many applications. I brought you source number 21. Talk about somebody who testifies alone. This is a classic story out of the Talmud. There was a case where a fellow named Tuvia did something wrong. And Zigud came to testify against him in front of the sage Rav Papa. Rav Papa whipped Zigud, the person who testified, the witness. So Zigud says, I don't get it. Tuvia sinned and Zigud is whipped? To which he said, yeah. The Torah says, one witness shall not stand against someone. You testified alone against him. You have only given him a bad name. So we don't want you giving people a bad name. And this is applied in source number 22, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. I'll say it outside of the text. This is actually a second response on the topic. Everyone has experienced this. Anyone who ever went to elementary school, maybe if you were homeschooled, no, probably even if you were homeschooled. Anybody who ever went to elementary school is familiar with this scene. Somebody in the class does something wrong, right? Defaces something, does something bad, whatever it is, and the teacher says to the class, whoever knows who did it has to tell. You've all, I'm sure, familiar with some version of this. No?
Yeah.
This is a Canadian system. Yeah. So Rabbi Feinstein was asked, is this okay to do? And he said, absolutely not. You're not allowed to do that. And the person who asked him the question wrote back to him and said, but you're doing it in order to instruct the students to keep them from doing things that are wrong. And he said, absolutely not. Because what you're doing is encouraging the students to tell Lashon Hara. You're encouraging the students to say bad things about each other. He says, it's one thing if a student is altruistic, pure, and says, you know, I feel bad there was wrongdoing and I want to help everybody learn, and so therefore I'm going to say something. I don't know who the student is, but the but if I did, I wouldn't tell. The
we're also causing the class to embarrass this child in front of the rest.
Well, you could always do it in private. You could deal with the embarrassment issue. But yes, but the point is that he's saying you can't take this issue of harmful speech lightly. Add to that the issue of embarrassing people in public when you do blow the whistle in public. Meaning, word gets out. All the people who worked at Morton Theocol or wherever it is are going to have a terrible reputation. The Talmud compares embarrassing somebody in public to murder. That's in source number 23. It is classified as a biblical prohibition. Rabbi Moses Maimonides in source number 24 says a rabbinical court is licensed to do whatever it needs to do to punish somebody who embarrasses other people in public. And this applies, that one is not allowed to embarrass publicly, even if you are rebuking somebody for doing something wrong against another person. Even though we said you have to rebuke, Maimonides writes in source number 25, that when you're dealing with social matters, not everything, but you're dealing with social matters, you're not allowed to shame somebody in public. So what emerges is this. We ask the question of when do you tell and what are your motivations? So for the reason to tell is from a secular perspective to look out for the public, and Judaism adds looking out for the criminal as well as for God. We have concerns, though, against telling, both in terms of who we're going to harm from a general perspective, and in Judaism, the concern for harmful speech as well, and again, the practical difficulties involved in doing so. And because we have concern for the employer, what we'll do is we'll say, you have to go through the business first. The first step has to be you go up the ladder within the business. And that's what we see in the practical guidance. CPA Ontario wants everything done in-house. That's the principle I brought you from John McAvoy in source number 26. But in the interest of time, I'm not going to read it aloud. You can see it. But the principle is the up the ladder principle. You have to go through the business first, and that's seen on the next page in the guidance from CPA Ontario. I brought you two sources here from the CPA code. I'm going to skip to number 28 because it's the better one. 27 is from the preamble. But what they tell you to do in guidance number 5 in 28 is that if you were supposed to provide assurance on the financial statements of an entity and you believe it contains a misstatement, your first step is communicate the belief to the person who is responsible for the engagement. If after that you haven't succeeded, then you go to one of the firm's senior partners. Number 6, before communicating with the firm's senior partners, you better make sure you know what you're talking about. And those are the things that you have to consider in number 6. See whether there's somebody else you should communicate with. And then in number 7, what we're told is if you've done that, you've taken those steps, and you believe that the financial statements still contain a misstatement, what do? Resign from the engagement. They don't want you going outside of the firm with that information. The only time you can go outside goes back to what we said from the CPA Act, which is in the event that you believe that harm is going to come to society. If harm is going to come to society, you go outside the business, otherwise not. From a halachic perspective, we also say that you put the victim first and you do the report, but you try to do it in-house. Take a look. Source number 29 is just, if you wanted to see an example from CPA Ontario, they actually have a case called the case of the whistleblowing CPA that you can look at. It's a fairly simple and straightforward case. But if you take a look at source number 31, I'm jumping 30, but number 31 are the rules set down by Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan regarding how to tell. If you do believe that you are obligated to tell, because the Torah says, don't stand by while somebody's blood is shed, you have certain limitations on how you do it. Number one, only report personal experience or a verified account. This is my summary of what he wrote. Only personal experience or a verified account of it, not I saw something on a blog somewhere and now I'm going to repost it. Don't jump to conclusions about what happened. See if there's another way to avoid harm besides public disclosure. And that, to me, is where we say, go in-house rather than go outside if you can avoid it. Stick to the facts. Do not exaggerate. You can't have a personal agenda. Motivation matters as well. And make sure that the harm you cause to the subject is commensurate with the wrongdoing. You don't want to put somebody in a position where they're going to suffer much worse for something that was relatively benign. Okay. Are we clear so far? I know I'm rushing a little bit. I prepared maybe a little more than we had time for, but are we clear?
So Rambam
would
have been against
Pashkevelim. Sorry? So now I'm coming back to the Pashkevelim.
Yeah, but Rambam would have been against.
Yes, I think I believe so. Unless you're dealing with, he might make a distinction between social sin and something between man and God. Maybe there will be an exception there. So what happens to anonymous whistleblowing based on everything that we've said? There are actually two different kinds of anonymous whistleblowing. Again, there's external, where you go to the police, and then there's internal, where you deal with it in-house in the company. So clearly, as Moshe said in the beginning, there are benefits in providing anonymity, right? Because you give the whistleblower the confidence in her own safety. So for that reason, anonymity makes sense. But there are two problems. Problem number one, just from a secular perspective, problem number one is that we want to protect the employer wherever possible. If you go outside and you do it anonymously, you're hurting your employer. You're not giving the employer the opportunity to actually deal with whatever it is that is wrong. And that's the point that McAvoy makes in source number 32. An anonymous disclosure of information is inconsistent with an employee's duty of loyalty to the employer. It also raises questions about your motivations. Do you want to fix the problem, or do you want to hurt the organization? So that's one problem. Number two, we said that you need to inform so that change will be made. But if you do it anonymously, you may not succeed in generating change at all, because it's not something that is easily investigated. When there's an anonymous report, people are not able to come back and ask you questions and get verification for what's been said. And that's in number 33 from the CSA group. They make this point. Now, they also note that there are modern structures that can be used, even with anonymity. There are paid services where you can have some third party you go through, and that's a way to deal with it. But the other problem is the lack of accountability. You don't have accountability, and that's a major problem. So if you take a look at source number 34, which was an Ontario government commissioned report.
It
ends
at 32.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, the last slide wasn't written. So I will read it aloud. Sorry. That's funny. Okay, it's all right. Those who are here and signed in are going to get a follow-up email, and I will include the handout. But listen to the report. This is an Ontario government report called the Changing Workplaces Review. Anonymous information may lead to an inspection under the ministry's proactive enforcement program, but it does not serve as the basis for a complaint that may be sent for investigation. It may trigger an inspection, but that's it. This seems a reasonable way to deal with complaints in circumstances where the identity of the complainant is not known to the ministry staff, who in cases of an anonymous complaint are not in a position to ask questions of the complainant in order to obtain additional relevant information to assess the validity of or motive behind such a complaint, including whether the complaint is vexatious. Which is a good word. Ministry staff will have to make a judgment call on whether to initiate an inspection based on a number of factors, including but not limited to the specificity of the factual allegations and the sector. This seems to be a reasonable approach. So what they're saying is the information is really not all that reliable. There's no accountability here. So maybe we'll do an inspection if we think that there's reason to, but that's about it. So for two reasons, the anonymous whistleblower is actually at a disadvantage in the system in the sense that what they're doing really doesn't do what we need them to do. Number one, they're not protecting their employer if they go outside. And number two is they're not necessarily going to generate the change that they say they're trying to generate. From a halachic perspective, there's an additional problem, which is you've lost tochacha. They're not rebuking the person who is doing wrong and giving them an opportunity to learn and grow. So we're not big fans of this idea of anonymous whistleblowing, and this goes back also to that Chafetz Chaim we quoted about the Pashkevilim, who was upset, and he says that you're guilty of Arur Makere Ehu Basaser, striking somebody in secret. Not that you're striking them in secret, you're letting the world know, but you're doing the striking in a way that protects your identity. In the event that we said, well, this is the only way in which society is going to be protected, people are going to get hurt if you don't let me do it anonymously. Some will say, okay, so do it. But it's really not ideal ethically from both a secular perspective and a halachic perspective. I'm going to be here to answer questions and so on, but if people need to bench and go, I don't want to hold everybody up because I know that we're at 50 minutes and that's usually what we design these for. But I want to make sure to note Rabbi Abbey is going to be speaking next week at 12:30, God willing, on charitable donations. Ambiguous charitable donations. Even better. But I'm going to stick around here to answer questions. Again, thank you so much to Zeichman's for making this possible. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Moshe.